This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. This election year is shaping up, by most accounts, to be one of the most dramatic and historic in recent memory. The emergence of high-profile candidates who don't fit into the establishment of the two-party mold is central to that. Donald Trump promises fascism and is arguably a direct product of fear-mongering by the Republican Party and right-wing media. Bernie Sanders offers a political revolution, but is finding out that doing so within the confines of the Democratic Party is nearly impossible. In the meantime, are our social and political movements being derailed yet again by the political theater of elections? My guest Chris Hedges just wrote, quote, "There are mechanisms to wrest back our democracy. Voting in presidential elections is not one of them." Chris Hedges is the author of numerous best-selling books, including Empire of Illusion, Death of the Liberal Class, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which he co-wrote with Joe Sacco. His latest book is Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. He writes a weekly column for the online magazine Truthdig. Welcome to Rising Up, Chris.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, obviously, the emergence of Donald Trump and his ongoing popularity is extremely disturbing. And I'm wondering whether you think that his emergence, being so sort of dramatic in this election, is exactly the kind of bogeyman argument that liberal establishment, political class elites are, you know, excited about being able to use to say, if you don't want Donald Trump, got to bring in the establishment.
Yes, although I think it's, you know, the phenomena of Trump is actually more frightening than a choice between a kind of proto-fascist candidate and an establishment candidate who we will assume to be Hillary Clinton. Trump is the consequence of decades of assault under neoliberal economics and corporate power of the American citizenry. He speaks in that kind of racist, bigoted, hyper-masculine language, which is typical to fascist movements. But that language has been embraced in a more subtle way, not just by the Republican Party, but by the Democratic Party as well, by co-opting the law and order issue. And that was a initiative begun by the Clintons and Joe Biden, that they would, wrest that issue away from the Republican Party. The Clintons, when they first came to prominence within the party in 1992, rewrote the Democratic platform to focus on law and order issues, erasing much of the progressive agenda that had been put in by Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition. Of course, under Clinton, we get the Omnibus Crime Bill in 1994 that explodes the prison population by almost a million people. The three strikes, you're outlaws. So what we've seen is a kind of competition between both parties to serve corporate power and disenfranchise the underclass. The difference was that politics essentially became a form of anti-politics and was defined by the culture wars. So the Democrats continued to speak in the traditional feel-your-pain language of liberalism, inclusivity, diversity, tolerance, multiculturalism, and the Republicans retreated into the embrace of the Christian right, nativists, neo-Confederates. And so as the white underclass was sold out, the demagogues in the Republican Party, Trump essentially catering to this kind of tactic, could say, look, your communities have been destroyed, your livelihoods have been taken from you, you have been pushed into economic misery and despair because those liberals have preferred marginalized groups to you. Now, of course, that wasn't true. The Democratic Party assault against, even under Barack Obama, against African Americans has been even more vicious than the assault against poor whites. 1 in 50% of young African American men are unemployed. Since 2008, the income in African American households has fallen off a cliff. But it works because of the disingenuousness within the Democratic establishment. I think we have to look at Trump, and I do think that he has, you know, fascist tendencies, but I kind of look at him the way anthropologists look at crisis cults, where you reach a point of such deterioration and decay that you cough up these figures that preach fantasy. We can go back to the end of the genocide of Native Americans, the rise of the ghost dance, where, you know, if you put on the ghost dance shirt, bullets couldn't penetrate the cloth. The buffalo herds were going to come back. The white men were going to disappear. The old great warriors were going to rise up from the underworld and repopulate the earth. I look at Trump like that. These, you know, speaking in his fourth grade level, we're going to win. We're going to win. Apple's going to make all its products here. We're going to be great again. It's so severed from our reality, yet it appeals to people who are desperate. So I don't like to reduce what's happening to personalities because I think it's far worse than that. I think Trump is not creating phenomena. He's responding to phenomena. And if the establishment in the form of Hillary Clinton is able to triumph in the general elections, and yet there's no significant change in terms of neoliberal policies, then we may get rid of Trump, but we will get something as vile or worse. And we haven't even begun to talk about climate change. We have no time left. Paris was a step backwards. You know, I just watched Josh Fox's good movie on climate change. And in there, he makes the point that climate scientists are saying that if by 2020, we do not cut carbon emissions by 80%, the Greenland ice sheet will no longer exist, which means that, you know, most coastal cities, including some inland cities like London, will go underwater.
And also, of course, climate change has hardly been raised as an issue during this campaign, yet it is the existential crisis of our time. And it's surprising to me that even Bernie Sanders, who does have a platform on the issue, hasn't made it central. But that's also partly perhaps because it's not something that the American media brings up often enough as an election issue. Wouldn't it be amazing if election candidates realized that they, in order to win votes, their position on climate change had to be one of the most important positions they could take? But
well, it should be. I mean, you know, we're not only facing a global emergency, but, you know, if we don't radically reconfigure our relationship to the ecosystem and to each other, we're going to have to start facing the extinction of the human species.
So, Chris, what do you make of, you know, and I'm glad you said that rather than focus on personalities, we should be looking at these as phenomenon, that the Trump is a phenomenon. What do you make of the other phenomenon that has risen up in response to Trump? We saw over the weekend in Arizona, you know, now many places in Chicago before that. It seems as though wherever Trump tries to go, particularly when he enters big cities, cosmopolitan cities, we see movements on the ground, many of them including Black Lives Matter activists who are gathering on the streets or organizing or mobilizing. How important is that as a phenomenon this election?
Well, that's the only tool we have left. Yeah. I mean, Chicago's the kind of case study for this. So you have the police murder of Laquan McDonald, and suddenly nobody gets police permits anymore. They just go out into the street. Rahm Emanuel, you know, can barely go out in public anymore. They got rid of that attorney general. That is the only mechanism we have left. And I would include shutting down Trump rallies, although remember, Bernie Sanders opposes this. I don't oppose it because it's hate speech. They're hate rallies, just as we should shut down the Klan or shut down any proto-fascist movement. This has no place in a civil society. And I think we have to begin to mobilize on every issue. I've been extremely critical of Bernie Sanders because he works within the toxic embrace of the Democratic Party and because he has said that he will campaign for the nominee, which I assume will be Hillary Clinton. He has a long history of campaigning for Democratic nominees, Clinton in 92, again in 96. And this was after Clinton had passed.
This is Bill Clinton.
Yeah, Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. After he'd passed NAFTA, after he destroyed the welfare system, after he'd passed the Omnibus Crime Bill. 2004, when I was working for Ralph Nader, Sanders was one of those voices calling on Nader not to run. So his track record is such that I have no doubt that he will be out there attempting to funnel this energy and money back into the Clinton campaign. And at that point, he becomes an impediment to reform, not an advocate.
Well, Chris, given the incredible numbers of people that have been showing up to Bernie Sanders' rallies, I mean, he's basically had the biggest events of any candidate, probably in history, and the number of people who've made donations to him, unprecedented, small donations, how many millions of Americans have donated to him. Do you think that all of these Americans are going to just fall lockstep and say, all right, since Sanders is now supporting Clinton, we'll back what he's doing? I mean, it seems highly unlikely. He's right. going to piss off a lot of people if he does that.
I don't think they will. I mean, I'm guessing, maybe a third of them will. But I think the rest of them will become politically passive. They say, well, we try. Mm. And, I and Shama Sawant in particular had pushed Sanders to run as an independent because we need to build a successful third-party movement. Imagine if that amount of money and that amount of energy and those votes had gone into building a viable third-party alternative. But this was something that Sanders has refused to do. He told me that he didn't want to end up like Ralph Nader. Well, what he's really saying is, I don't want to lose my Senate seat because the Democrats don't run a serious candidate against him. I don't want to lose my seniority in the Democratic caucus, and I don't want to be pushed like Nader into the political wilderness. Well, he's not wrong. I mean, the Democratic Party would do that. My anger with him is that he's, in essence, sacrificing all of this energy, all of this commitment, and all of this political mobilizing for his career.
One would argue that he wouldn't have reached where he was had he not used the Democratic Party all this time to begin with.
Well, he's an honorary Democrat. I mean, as Howard Dean says, he votes 98% of the time with the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders, and I think Sanders has more integrity than someone like Obama. I think has very little, or Clinton, that has none. Sanders is not going to call out the Democratic establishment for their deep complicity in creating this kind of neo-feudalistic, what Sheldon Wolin calls our system of inverted totalitarianism. He'll criticize Clinton for taking a lot of money for speeches, but the Clintons are far dirtier than that. He has a long relationship with them, which he wants to maintain, and he knows he'll be campaigning for her pretty soon.
So, Chris, then rather than that, say, approximately two-thirds of Sanders supporters who might fall into the politics of despair, rather than them turning apathetic, you suggest in a piece that you recently wrote for Truth Dig that people could vote with their feet. What would you like to see happen, particularly at the Democratic and Republican conventions this July?
Well, I'd love to see us shut both of them down, just to expose the political theater that this has become. What we care for, the candidates we want, our vote. I mean, remember, Clinton went into this race with about 500 more delegates than Sanders before one vote was cast. And she's got this giant patronage machine. I think that in a fair vote, she wouldn't get the nomination. I think, in fact, Sanders could probably win the presidency in a fair vote. But we don't live in a system where... what we care about or what we want is relevant to the centers of corporate power. And we see that in the forms of legislation where they write bill after bill that nobody wants except corporations. So I think we have to focus on rebuilding movements. I think we've seen that. We saw that in Phoenix when they pulled the cars in front of the road. I thought that was brilliant. I have, tremendous admiration for primarily the African-American community that's risen up in Chicago with such courage and such resilience and really affected change, but they've affected change by going out on the streets. We need to, spread that into the fracking, raising the minimum wage. That's where our energies have to go. I will vote for the Green Party candidate, which looks like it'll be Jill Stein that I voted for in the last election. But at this point, that's not where our energy has to go. We have to go into building movements that take down this system And, you know, if we look at the latest climate change reports, we have very little time left.
And bringing up the issue of how African-American organizers have mobilized in Chicago, one of the things that they did during the primary race in Illinois, in the local races there, as well as communities in Cleveland, Ohio, was that they voted out those states' attorneys who had failed miserably on, on holding police accountable for the killings of African-Americans. And so you see this really, I think, very useful strategy of people being out on the streets, express and mobilizing, but then also using their vote very strategically in local elections, something we just don't see enough of.
Yeah, I mean, locally, we can still affect some change. Nationally, and I speak, you know, I was a speechwriter for Nader, so I watched it up close. There are just so many impediments the two parties throw up to a third-party presidential candidate, including, of course, locking them out of the debates, challenging their voter lists, that it makes it almost impossible. But I think locally, and Chicago's a good example of that, you know, there's a lot of ferment in cities like Baltimore. Yeah, there's more hope there. But the primary focus of our energy has to be on building these movements, not on voting for this or that candidate.
So finally, let me ask you, Chris, what you make of the fact that as we still have many more states that have yet to vote, even before the conventions come about, the election season is quite long. Are you hoping that we'll see more mobilization on the streets, more mobilizations or during primary races, more mobilizations during campaign events as well? But really with a long view, because one of the things that activists tend to do, progressives tend to do, is we tend to have our movements derailed every 4 years by electoral politics. We tend to pour all our, and we tend to get behind candidates rather than asking candidates to get behind us. But there's still time to change, possibly, with the rest of these races.
I put a lot of energy into shutting down Trump hate rallies.
Yeah.
This is the role of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. Figures like Van Jones play this. You know, remember he was running around saying "Occupy the vote" in the last election, and you know, unfortunately, this is the role Bernie Sanders is about to play. And the Democratic Party has very effectively neutered the left as a political force in this country by using that mantra of the least worst. Now, look, Trump is a terrifying figure, without question, but we're not going to get rid of Trump or Trump's replacement by supporting the establishment candidate like Hillary Clinton, because she's the reason we have a Trump. And I think, in fact, the Democrats are probably playing a very dangerous game. Remember, twice as many people are voting in the Republican primaries as are voting in the Democratic primary. And she embodies everything that all of us, you know, have come to loathe, including this tremendous artificiality. I mean, there isn't a word that comes out of her mouth that hasn't been tested in front of God knows how many focus groups. So, and Trump, you know, will, like Bernie. I mean, Bernie's great asset is that he speaks to our reality, but so does Trump. He talks about jobs. He talks about, putting tariffs on Carrier. He admits openly that he gives money to both parties because that's how it works, and he calls these people up and they do what they want. So it's a right-wing populism, but it has an element of populism to it, which, of course, is what makes it dangerous.
And in fact, there was news recently that hadn't got much traction that Trump actually made a phone call to Bill Clinton in the weeks before deciding to announce his run for the presidency to get his opinion, that he actually had a conversation with Bill Clinton, and Bill essentially, according to reports, thought, he's not admitting exactly what was said, but it is thought that he essentially encouraged him. Why not? And we know that the Clintons have been to Trump's wedding, et cetera. It's really interesting that not more is being made of this unholy previous alliance between Clintons and Trumps, particularly given Hillary Clinton's now stated disgust with Donald Trump.
Well, they all come out of the same class, they all run in the same circles, and they all serve the interests of the corporate elites. I mean, it's the same club.
So finally, also, Chris, where's the best place for people to read your works? And are you also going to be heading to the conventions in July and attempting to work with activists on the ground?
The problem with the conventions is that, you know, and this isn't new, that the cities where the conventions are held are, you know, they're essentially as de facto martial law. You can't move. You can't get within blocks of the convention center. Any kind of group that potentially might protest is being heavily monitored and infiltrated. You know, the militarized police forces on the ground will be, they will saturate the city. So it's, they've, you know, because the state is, has this pathological fear of protest, as it should, because it's completely discredited. So it'll be extremely hard in Cleveland or Philadelphia to get anywhere near the convention centers. That doesn't mean people should go. I don't know that it's worth the energy. I think it's probably more effective to do what people have done in Chicago, do what people have done in Phoenix, do what people are doing in Seattle in terms of blocking the trains. I don't know that I want to invest that much energy trying to negotiate police barricades to get within 15 blocks of the convention center.
Well, we'll see what plays out. Chris, I always appreciate your analysis. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll post a link to your article on truthdig.com from our website. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
My guest is Chris Hedges. He is a best-selling author. His books include War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, Empire of Illusion, Death of the Liberal Class. His latest book is Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. And he's a weekly columnist at truthdig.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Visit us online at risingupwithsonali.com.